Welcome to KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Monday, July 10th of 2023. I'm your host, Jimmy Searfoss. Coming up on today's program, we'll go to History Colorado to look at the future of an ancient building material. And CityCast Denver scoops up the dirt on the city's new residential curbside composting program. After the BBC News headlines, we'll hear the latest commentary from Jim Hightower. Then it's Storytellers of Color with Rosanna Lungabetter. Her guest today is award-winning sports writer turned stand-up comedian Sam Adams. At 9 a.m. we'll bring you Counterspin, a look into fairness and accuracy in reporting. And at 9:30, Neil Smart will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all coming up, but first, the headlines from KGNU's Poor Jaijong Keat.
High temperatures affecting most of the nation are blowing into Colorado, bringing highs into the 90s through most of the week. Rains are forecast to return by Friday, bringing the temperatures back down to the 80s. Tolling on I-70 express lanes start tomorrow in northeast Denver. Last year, a free testing period was enacted for toll lanes, with plans to begin tolling in February. However, the Colorado Department of Transportation cited internal issues, delaying the start to this Tuesday. Toll rates will vary by time of day, ranging from lower prices at night to higher fees in the morning when traffic is the heaviest. Drivers with express toll transponders will have lower rates. Motorcycles, transit providers, and vehicles carrying at least three people will be able to use express lanes for free. A Summit County sheriff's deputy and an officer have been placed on paid administrative leave following the deadly shooting of an armed 18-year-old man on Sunday morning. According to the Summit Daily newspaper, the person killed was identified by family as Charlie Foster. His aunt, Monica Vasquez, said her nephew was experiencing a mental health crisis that morning. Vasquez said her nephew had a BB gun. A sheriff's office press release says officers tried to de-escalate the situation, but Foster repeatedly disregarded verbal commands, then pointed a handgun at authorities. Both the deputy and the officer, who have not been identified, then shot Foster. Paramedics pronounced him dead at the scene. Aurora police say a man accused of shooting two teenagers who tried to steal his car was arrested and will be charged with first-degree and attempted first-degree murder. 27-year-old Orest Scher went outside his home Wednesday evening after hearing his car alarm go off. According to the Sentinel, Scher said he confronted two people dressed in all black as they tried to break into his Hyundai Elantra on East 59th Place in Aurora. Police say the two people fled, then left in another suspected stolen vehicle. Scher pursued in his Hyundai, but the other vehicle crashed a short distance away. Scher then fired shots at them with his weapon. Paramedics then rushed one shooting victim to the hospital, where he died. The second victim, 13 years old, ran to a relative's house nearby, then took himself to the hospital. Police say he is expected to survive. The Colorado Air Quality Control Commission will soon consider phasing out gas-powered lawn equipment in several Front Range counties. Yvonne Olivas has the story.
If approved, the proposal would require local governments to stop using small gas-powered equipment during summer of 2025. The new regulation would ban gas-powered garden tools such as push mowers, leaf blowers, and chainsaws from stores. It would also ban their use by businesses and by the government. The commission says nine counties, including Boulder, Denver, Adams, and Jefferson, are in violation of federal clean air standards. According to the Denver Post, the Regional Air Quality Council formally recommended the policy Friday. It will go to the Colorado Air Quality Control Commission before it can become state policy. Researchers say the move to electric garden equipment could cut over 4,000 tons of greenhouse gases per day. That could lower the over-the-top ozone concentrations in the Front Range, bringing it to 20% closer to normal federal air quality limits. For KGNU, I'm Yvonne Olivas.
Officials reopened swim beaches at Cherry Creek State Park and Chatfield State Park this weekend after water testing showed a drop in E. coli levels. Kira Zizzo has more.
On Thursday, Colorado Parks and Wildlife closed both the Douglas and Denver County beaches because of dangerous bacteria levels. Chatfield reopened on Friday afternoon. Cherry Creek reopened on Saturday morning. Officials said that fecal waste from wildlife, runoff from city areas, and heavy rainfall may have caused the rise in bacteria. The town of Windsor also shut down most water activities at Windsor Lake Thursday until further notice because of suspected blue-green algae forming on the surface. The algae, a sign of cyanobacteria, can be toxic to humans and pets. The Colorado Department of Health and Environment is testing water samples from the lake to determine whether cyanobacteria is present. For KGNU, I'm Kira Zizzo.
While almost daily rains this summer have ended the long drought in Colorado, firefighters are still tackling new fires and watching forecasts for hot, dry weather. On Sunday afternoon, Summit County Fire and EMS responded to a small blaze near Lily Pad Lake in the Silverthorne area. According to the National Interagency Fire Center, the reported cause of the fire was human. As of Sunday, the Devil's Thumb Fire, first discovered July 4th, had reached 95 acres and was 30% contained. The cause of the fire was still undetermined. Firefighters are also battling a bigger blaze. The Spring Creek Fire, southwest of Parachute, is over 3,000 acres in size and almost 40% contained. Over 500 firefighters are battling the wildland fire, some using helicopters and drones. In Boulder and Denver, mostly sunny with a high near 92, a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. In Fort Collins, also sunny with highs in the mid-90s. For KGNU, I'm Por Jae-jung-kit.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm Jimmy Searfoss. Summer festivals are in full swing across Denver. If you were anywhere near History Colorado yesterday, perhaps in the throngs of cyclists riding the car-free Viva Denver streets, or within the crowds of the Denver Art Museum's Free Admission Day, or perhaps admiring the long lines of custom-made lowriders parked nearby, you may have noticed an earthen sculpture in the making. Architect and San Luis native Ronald Rial is behind the installation. KGNU News Director Shannon Young sat down with him during a break to chat about how he's combining new technology with one of humanity's oldest building materials.
My name is Ronald Rael. I'm from the San Luis Valley, but I'm also a professor of architecture at the University of California, Berkeley.
And this exhibit that you're doing here outside of History Colorado, it's called Mud Futures. What's it about?
Well, I grew up in buildings made of mud in the San Luis Valley, adobe we call it, and it's humankind's oldest building material. And what I'm doing today is showing that the future of construction can also be constructed of mud. And so I'm combining humankind's oldest building material with a new building technology called 3D printing.
How? How do you put mud or adobe through a 3D printer?
Well, the way we do it, traditional adobe has lots of rocks and things. I sift out those rocks, but it's still mud and straw mixed together, and I pump it through a pump, and that pump is attached to a hose. It moves through the hose, and the end of the hose is held by a robotic arm. And that robotic arm draws the mud and deposits the mud in any pattern or shape or form that we like.
And speaking of these shapes, these are not what one would typically think of as like adobe bricks or even a packed earth technique. These are like pillars of coils of mud. Is that an accurate description, or how would you describe this to somebody who's just listening?
Yeah, it's actually, if you can imagine, they look a little bit like a bundle of stacked rope that's coiled around something, but it's actually made of mud. And it's not too dissimilar to traditional pottery all over the world that's made out of coiled pottery, where you make long coils and you roll it up to make a pot. And so these pots, though, are very large and can be spatial and architectural.
As an architecture professor, have you found it difficult to find formal education in this type of building? Not necessarily the 3D printing, but in the use of adobe. Is there much formal education in that, or is it more about going back to the communities that have been using it for thousands of years and learning those techniques there?
Yeah, most formal architectural education deals with contemporary and modern materials like concrete, glass, steel, and even wood, but wood that's been increasingly homogenized. And so most of architecture today is made of homogeneous materials. And if we look at the construction of a wall, there's probably the representation of 12 to 20 different companies making different products, from paints to insulations. But the beauty and simplicity of the traditional material of mud is that there's one material, and it can be worked in different ways. It can be polished and smooth, it can be colored clay for the inside, it can be surfaced, and other materials can be added to it, like straw, to make it stronger and shed water a little bit more, or more clay. And so, in terms of formal education, we don't really learn that, because I think a lot of architectural education is geared towards relationships with companies that make products and learning how to use these products. So architectural education today is a lot like shopping for the right products versus a craft, which it once was, and not only craft of earth, but of wood, of stone, of other materials. So I think that the combination of using a robot allows, let's say, STEM education to be inserted into traditional cultural education. And I think that's a really nice hybrid, a way of thinking about using mathematics and robots and structures and traditional, environmental, culturally responsive materials.
Where did you learn about adobe? Not just learning about adobe, but how did you learn building techniques with adobe?
Sure. I grew up in houses made out of adobe. I continue to live in my great-grandfather's house that he built as a young man, and raised, you know, I guess five generations have lived in that house. My father was a builder, and because every house in the San Luis Valley, probably 90% of the houses we worked on, were made out of adobe. And my father also built new adobe houses. And so I always participated with him, just as my son does today, mixing mud there on the construction sites. And so I'm passing down this knowledge to him, but through a contemporary lens, I guess, because we're using robots, just as my father passed it down to me, using making adobe bricks and stacking them in mortar. And so that was my architectural education related to this traditional material.
What are the advantages to using adobe that just don't exist when you're building out of brick or wood?
Yeah, there's so many advantages to building out of adobe. I can say that adobe isn't just about, it's not just a building material, it is a cultural heritage practice. And so when you build with adobe, you're building with the community. And if you could look around right now, my son is here, some friends have come out from Denver, students have volunteered to come here, and we're all as a community, even though we're using a robot, building the structure. And that's how it is a community. So it's a community building process. As a material and its performance, it is super environmentally friendly. I know that's kind of a buzzword, but in fact, it has zero carbon emissions. It has, it produces no carbon dioxide in the construction, but it also creates a thermal comfort level on the interior of the house that is unparalleled. There's often a cliche, adobes stay warm in the winter and cool in the summer, and it's very, very true. It's the truth. And so beyond the cliche, I think we have a genetic connection to this material because we have engaged with earthen materials for hundreds of thousands of years. And so if you've ever entered into adobe house, often people say it feels so good, and that feeling is actually our connection to that material, where our bodies are reminded what a real home feels like. And so that's another advantage. And then there's an economic advantage, which it's very inexpensive. And if you have the community around you to work and do the labor, it's very rewarding to come together and build a house very inexpensively this way.
Are you finding that there is an upsurge in interest in these natural building materials as there's more consciousness about LEED certification or building with environmentally friendly materials? And do you think that adobe's future is seeing a resurgence?
I absolutely do, especially as a cultural heritage practice. And I see this in New Mexico and Southern Colorado, where many young people who have been disconnected from their culture and heritage for many different reasons are now attempting to reconnect. And adobe and the construction process and the cultural process, there's a clear resurgence of that. And it's not only in the building, it's in food and language. And I think that there's a palpable moment that's happening right now where we see how cultural shifts that were imposed upon certain people, especially during the 1950s, and created a generational gap of the loss of craft and knowledge, is raising a lot of questions that young people today are saying, hey, we want to return to those ways, because they see the evidence of the problems that those changes in culture and their consequences have done to their culture over time. And so, just to give you a very clear example, if you drive through rural New Mexico or southern Colorado, you often see an old adobe house next to a trailer or a double wide. And there are a lot of reasons that that is a reality in the built landscape, but the grandparents' houses were often abandoned because of that lack of cultural knowledge to know how to repair the house. And so often then you go and buy a trailer instead of fix the grandparents' house, and the grandparents' house fall into disrepair. I think there's a generation coming up that says, hey, we want to fix our grandparents' house. And we recognize that the trailer is filled with asbestos and fiberglass insulation and all the, and it's rotting, and there's no way to fix it. There's no way to fix those kinds of buildings. And so they just end up in the landfill rather than end up as adobe houses do, as productive land.
Professor Ronald Rael, is there anything else that you would like to add that I didn't bring up in a question?
Sure. Well, I just want to let your listeners know that they can stop by History Colorado and see the 3D printed adobe in the future if they'd like to, because it's going to be here for several weeks on view, and you can touch it, you can feel it and look at it, and to just think about and ask the people who are your relatives and the elders if they've ever lived in adobe houses and what is their connection to the land and the earth.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
For KGNU, I'm Shannon Young.
At the start of the month, the city of Denver officially launched its free residential curbside composting program, which will serve more than 180,000 households across the Mile High. That means that now, along with recycle and trash bins, Denverites will also have a composting bin to help cut down even more on what goes into the landfill. But the rules behind composting have changed in the time it took for Denver to approve, plan, and launch its curbside composting program. CityCast Denver host Bree Davies spoke with the podcast's official gardening and dirt expert, Anne-Marie Awad, to get into the down and dirty details of what you can and can't put in Denver's curbside compost.
As they roll out this giant program, they have to get everybody on the same page. And
yes,
it sounds like there was just too big of a margin of error of folks putting the wrong stuff in the compost.
Yeah, yeah. So I actually spoke to somebody at Wampos out in Aurora about this. And sort of their point of view is a bunch of new folks are part of this compost program that weren't before. And so they don't have the habit and they aren't necessarily used to how it works. And so they're just sort of like throwing a lot of things in there, understandably, that they think are compostable. And a lot of what they run into are the like plastic cups and plastic takeaway containers that are labeled compostable, but like a lot of them aren't. Or people will throw them out and they contain something that's not compostable, or they're inside a non-compostable bag. And so like people aren't actually just going through and sorting out all of their waste. And what you're talking about is like the really, really hard balance to find, right? Like it's got to be easy enough so that a lot of people could do it, right? Everybody's going to get composting. So you got to be able to throw in all these things and not have to be sitting there and you know, agonizing over every tea bag and coffee filter, right?
Right.
But at the same time, A1's got a point. You know, if they start getting really bogged down with a lot of these things that they can't take, they're spending so much time sorting it out themselves. Compost is can't continue to be free anymore, right? The cost of actually doing it goes up. And
that will probably push folks out of doing it. And I see the city's point is make it as easy as possible to get folks in the habit of doing it.
Yeah. And I think it's also really important to know that this is just getting rolled out to residential customers.
Mm-hmm.
So businesses will still have to sort of like find a composter if they are interested in doing it. For example, just like a I learned the word is micro composter.
What's a micro composter?
It's just like a small business where they'll come and pick up your stuff. So Wampost is one, and they operate mainly out in Aurora. Depending on where you live in the city, there just might be a local, like you're saying, a neighborhood program as well. And some of these might have more flexibility about what they can take. So, for example, when I spoke with Wampos, they told me that they don't actually work with A1 Organics. They work with another composter called GFL. And GFL can take a lot of those
things that we can't put in the city compost.
That you can't
now.
Put in the city compost, exactly. And so business customers still have some kind of alternative.
Because businesses are not in the city program at this point, right? It only serves residents.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's just be clear on what you can put in the city compost when you use the compost bin that's next to your trash and recycle. What can go in that compost?
Still a lot of things. You can still throw in any organic waste. You could throw in meat still, I believe.
You can also put like yard waste, like leaves, grass clippings, branches, any sort of organic materials from your yard, weeds that you pull. You can put all of that in your compost as well.
The things that they're wanting you to keep out are cardboard, and particularly spoiled cardboards, no pizza boxes. And I believe any of that stuff, any of the takeaway ware, plasticware, quote unquote,
even
plasticware.
Even if it says compostable.
Even if it says compostable, because again, it's kind of like organic where anybody can throw that word around, but like whether or not it's actually organic is there's like nobody really keeping track.
So the levels of like, who knows if that's compostable? Is it the grade of compostable plastic or whatever that A1 can handle? Is it really
certified compostable is the term that I've heard. But I believe I have to double check. I think A1 is going a step further and just saying none of that stuff.
OK, so it's food waste like banana peels. If you peel
coffee
your carrots.
Grounds.
Coffee grounds. Great one. Any meat scraps. And the other thing I want to make sure we mention is if you are someone who has the little composting bin in your house that you collected in and then take it out, kind of like your trash can, you can put those green compostable bags that are like certified compostable. Those can also go in there. So don't worry about that. That part doesn't have to change for your behavior.
Yeah,
for sure.
Exactly.
Okay. So say I'm a person who's like, I want to go off the grid, man. How do I do my own backyard composting? Is it like something that like anybody can do? And is it legal to have a compost like pile in your yard?
I think it's totally doable. It's about like your expectations, right? So I think something I did and I think a lot of people do is they just like go into it expecting that they're going to get compost. And the thing is like if you buy a lot of those like tumblers or bins or stuff like that, they'll tell you that. They'll be like, get beautiful finished compost in like 6 weeks. And that usually doesn't happen. It's just not. But that's fine. I have a big compost bin in my backyard that's open from the bottom, and then it has a bunch of openings around the sides to let air in. That is yard waste, kitchen waste. And I don't expect anything from it. I give and I give and I give and I never get anything back. There are things you have to keep in mind.
Okay.
So if you're living in the city, critters are the biggest concern. I mean, honestly, if you're living in the suburbs too.
Sure. Squirrels. If you live,
yes. But
skunks, raccoons.
In the city, you'll get rats.
Rats.
And so it's very important that you have enough space to keep it away from your house. Because there is a good chance you're going to attract critters, and that it is sealed or covered somehow. So like an open compost heap in the city is not a great idea. You probably will attract some stuff and you'll make your neighbors mad. People love doing the vermicomposting, which is the worms. And you can do the worms in an apartment if you're not icked out by that. Basically, it's like a bin where you have levels where you separate out the compost, and then on each level is a bunch of worms, and they will eat your organic waste, and they break it down a lot faster than sort of like the normal way. And you will more than likely get usable compost out of that pretty quickly. You know, you can do it in a small space. People really like it for apartments. It keeps, and again, because the decomposition is like happening the right way, it keeps the smell way down. People tend to love worms. Not all people.
I know. I was like, don't love worms. So, I mean, I love what they do for the earth, but I don't want to be close to them in my home.
You don't want to do the worms.
What is A1 doing with our food waste when we send it to them?
If you are a Ace Hardware shopper, you will probably see the EcoGrow compost available for sale. That's where it goes.
The fact that we can see the fruits of the fact that we've decided to put our food waste in a specific bin and now we get something out of it is pretty cool. So we'll have that. We'll have some links to some other alternative places if you want to do sort of a deeper level composting than the cities. And then we'll also have a link to the cities page because they have a great FAQ on every question you might possibly have about composting in the city. The city of Denver has really answered it on their page. And also, I'll just give a shout out again to the Denver Waste Management has an app that's super easy to use. Anne-Marie, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Always happy to talk dirt.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.
That is all for today's Morning Magazine. Special thanks to Benita Lee, Poor Jaijong Keat, Kira Zizzo, Alexis Kenyon, Jack Armstrong, Shannon Young, Yvonne Olivas, and the CityCast Denver crew for their contributions for today's program. I've been your host, Jimmy Searfoss. Stay tuned for a commentary from Jim Hightower, then it's Storytellers of Color with Rosanna Longabetter. But that's just after these news updates from the BBC.